Hello, my friends. Kyle Tierman here, and this episode of the podcast is with a good friend of mine. A couple years ago, I moved to the west side of Los Angeles, a little more than 2 years ago now, and I had the striking realization that I needed to make new friends because I was in a big new city and didn't know many people outside of work. So I went to a surf movie premiere and met a dude named Dylan, who was cool. He was just, I could tell, you just tell sometimes when people have good vibes. And he offered to take me spearfishing. Didn't need to do that. You know, growing up in a small town, often we were less than friendly to outsiders. People who just moved into town. And Dylan didn't need to do that, but he did. And we started going diving together. Then I found out he's a damn fine surfer as well. Started going surfing together. Then I found out that he's a fucking citizen entomologist and takes trips around the world looking for bugs. And I was like, dude, you're the coolest person I've ever met in my life. and he really is. He's one of those dudes who I feel if you could just multiply him a million times, all of the world's problems would be solved. And I finally got him to sit down for an interview. Dylan Sonjan is an LA-based citizen entomologist, ocean dude, and youth surf program director from San Pedro, California. He experiences the natural world through insects, spearfishing, and surfing in his attempt to fulfill an exciting life. Turns out that surfing and insect collecting pair well, creating a natural pursuit for bugs and barrels through natural understanding. Dylan holds tight to the belief that while remote Indo-Borneo wilderness is heaven, there is incredible nature and adventure to be had right at home in Los Angeles, whether it's spearfishing prize fish or surfing or looking in the local bushes. Dylan is 29 years old. Oh, and this is my own little tangent on his bio. He spent a great deal of time in Indonesia, where he volunteered with an organization called SWIMDO, which addresses the crises of children drowning across Indonesia. Drowning in Indonesia and across Southeast Asia is one of the leading causes of death among children. And then when I went to Bali this past summer, he introduced me to the group SWIMDO, and I was able to write an investigative piece on that group and my experience learning about what they're doing. So that piece is up on my Substack, tierman.substack.com right now, and it's called Chicken Airplane Police. That's tierman.substack.com. You can go there to check out all of my writing and get my weekly newsletter. Now, without further ado, please welcome to the show, Dylan Sonjan.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part about Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
All right, and we're off. Dylan, I'm so happy to finally cajole you into this chair. After many adventures together, many conversations unrecorded, we're finally getting you into the studio, and by the studio, I mean living room.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to delve into some things that most people are not very privy to, and I kind of, this blew my socks off when I first met you, that you're a bug guy.
I am.
You're
I
a bug guy.
Bugs. Love it.
You love bugs. What do you love about bugs, man? What's to love?
You can experience the world through bugs. Like, I think a lot of people who love nature and grew up in nature, exploring, hiking. I think that bugs are kind of the entry to being like really tactile and engaging with it. Like for me, going to the nature preserve, rolling some logs and catching some bugs, that was my way of really falling in love with the natural world and engaging with it. And I think I'm just a natural born collector. So I love collecting things. So I was like, it's like Pokemon, you know, gotta catch them all.
So you grew up in San Pedro.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So which is a little community, a blue collar community in South LA, mm-hmm. Kind of by the port, by the Long Beach port.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So we're sandwiched between Port of LA, you know, massive, massive port. It's huge industrial. And then Palos Verdes, which is the hill. It's nice. It's green. And so San Pedro, we're right in there. It's a little slice of paradise. Right. It's different than a lot of California, though, especially Southern California, Orange County. It's cool.
Right. So I went through that neighborhood with you, and you showed me was the nature preserve. You're like, oh, when I was a kid, I'd go look for bugs around here.
That was the one.
So you grew up as – did you do junior guards growing up?
No.
You didn't. Okay. But you were – What were you into as a kid?
Dude, I was into bugs.
You were into bugs.
I was into bugs. I was happy to go out there on my own. I was lucky my mom would go out with me. I dragged my little brother. He was down. Okay. It's kind of crazy. And
this is before you were into surfing.
This is before I was into surfing. Okay. Yeah.
You were into bugs.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember not being into bugs. I'm not going to lie.
Wow.
It's deep.
It goes deep. Yeah. You got the bug early.
Yeah.
Okay. And the early experiences were in this nature preserve. So describe this spot for me.
So this is a plot of land that was held by the military, actually. And there's like Nike missile flats that have like they would raise giant missiles out and they could shoot them past Catalina, basically. So this is like World War II and then into like Korean War times, I believe. And so it was abandoned, chain link fenced off. It was mostly weeds. And then as time went on, it became a nature preserve. Actually, my mom was part of the group that really rallied to make it a nature preserve. It was almost became soccer fields, which would have been tragic. It would have been terrible. You know, yeah, so many bugs out there.
Tragic for the Beatles.
Bugs and lizards.
What if the soccer team's names were like the Beatles and the Hornets?
I would have cried. It's been insult to injury, you know. So this nature preserve, it's on the cliff, looking out over the ocean. You can see Catalina, and I grew up across the street. Awesome little spot. When I grew up, it was weeds, and we had to crawl under the chain link fence. We had to crawl under this little hole. It was pretty fun. It felt like we were breaking the rules, but you know, I knew where all the rotten logs were out there. I had my spots, some sheet metal. That's where all the snakes were usually. And yeah, very lucky to have it.
Okay. And then early on, were you collecting the bugs and bringing them back? Like how did this journey progress from just being curious about bugs to becoming an amateur entomologist, which
yeah.
I dare you to try and say five times fast.
Yeah, man. So, yeah, I mean, it starts with just a couple bug containers. I don't remember when that started, but still got my bug containers. And then my mom took me to a Natural History Museum event. They have the Bug Fair every year. I still go. It's pretty rad. And that was the first time I had seen bugs in collections pinned. And so I got some bug boxes and pins, and then I had a way of doing my collections, and I was into it. I was full on. So I would make my own collections. For a time, I would save up some of my money to buy other bugs, which is what most people do at this event, actually, is these are collectors from around the world bringing insects that they collect
and
selling them so people could make these display boxes.
Right.
And so I did that a little bit growing up. I still have one display of the stuff I bought when I was a kid that – you know, it reminds me of the good old days of doing that, but
it really is like Pokemon cards.
Yeah, except for there's a million. pretty quickly, I was kind of over the whole buying other people's bugs thing, you know, school, but no, I catch my own bugs, man.
Shape your own surfboards.
Yeah, exactly. I catch my own bugs.
Okay, so with these glass containers, I'm kind of picturing them. How do you preserve a bug in a glass container?
There's no preservatives. Okay. It's all about humidity. So most bugs have an exoskeleton, all the juicy good stuff's on the inside. That'll just dry up, leaving the exoskeleton as is. That's mostly for beetles. Some stuff like spiders, they got a squishy butt, it's not going to work the same. But it's really just about controlling the humidity, making sure it's dry. So, you know, if you're in the tropics, you can like really encounter some problems, but you want to keep it dry, clean. And that's really kind of the key to it. So it's pretty easy. If you're a kid, you don't need any fancy equipment. You can really do it yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
What were some of your favorite bugs to collect as a kid?
man, scorpions.
Scorpions.
100%.
Okay.
Even though there was only two species to my knowledge in the nature reserve across the street from my house, and one of them was like a mythical, like burrowing scorpion I'd only found like one or two of. But they're still so fun. They're cool. I mean, that's pretty, they're pretty, pretty rad.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember my brother used to have a scorpion belt buckle. Cool shit. It was like preserved in amber.
Yeah.
You just cruise around like
legend.
Women just throwing themselves out of it. Just, I had to fend them off. I was like, can't do this.
Yeah. And then, that evolved into everyone else's favorite insect, which would be the wasps. So every, there'd be like a certain time of year when these rare, pretty cool wasps would come around. And so that was my next challenge.
And then are you collecting live wasps?
A few.
A few.
A few.
And others, you're collecting dead bugs.
No, no, no. Everything I collect, 99% is alive when I find it.
Like, okay.
You're not very often finding a well-preserved dead insect in nature. They get consumed pretty quick.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. And you're looking under logs. You're looking under, and you're looking, you're checking out snakes too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it progresses pretty fast, but the thing about snakes is, you know, there's only a few species around, you know, I caught them all pretty quick growing up. So, less interesting.
Is it like hunting where you go in the morning or the evening?
Can be, depending on what you're doing. We're not back in the day now. Like if we're talking about now, if I'm going out for bugs,
yeah.
You're going to encounter different stuff during different time of the day. So it depends on what you're targeting or going after, which generally now I'm not really targeting too much specifically. You know, I'm really, more grazing, I guess. I don't know. I'm just experiencing what's happening wherever I am.
Right.
Seeing what's out there and exploring, and I have ideas of what I might find, but, I'm looking for surprises, really. That's the best part.
Okay. So what are some common bugs that, let's say in Southern California, someone might find if they go out on a hike, or something to look for, and how they might look for it just on the next hike that they go on?
Yeah. So something that I love about it is you don't necessarily start always looking for the bugs. What I like to do is I start looking for the plants. And so you look for different kinds of plants. Often when they're young, they're growing, like it's springtime now, it's flowering. You know, if I'm looking at all the yellow flowers, I'm probably going to find the same kinds of insects on those. But then if I find some, there's a plant called a bladder pod. You know, it's pretty cool native Southern California plant. They'll have specific beetles and bugs that love that. So a lot of the time I'm looking for these different plants and then the specialist bugs that live with them, and their habitat.
Okay. And are you researching the plants beforehand? You kind of know what they look like.
I have an idea of what I'm looking for different sometimes, but more often there's so many plants out there, man.
Yeah.
It's exciting. Like, you know, I'm not necessarily going out knowing what I'm going to find. That wouldn't be as fun.
Right. But by proxy of your interest in bugs, you've learned about plants.
Yeah. That's cool.
That is cool.
Yeah.
That is very cool. Yeah. And there was a time when you wanted to be an entomologist. Is that right?
Totally, yeah.
You're like, I'm going to do this.
Field biologist, entomologist.
Like when I was a kid, I wanted to be a professional skater. You wanted to be a professional entomologist.
Yep, 100%. Out in the jungle, just collecting stuff.
Okay, so what attracted to you about that career? Obviously the bugs, but like, did you meet entomologists early on?
Well, I would say this dream had nothing to do with career. This was like, that's just what I wanted to do.
Right, right.
You know, I wanted to be, and I wouldn't necessarily say that there were particular people I was looking at this stage when I was really like thinking about doing that, which I did explore through college, you know, university, and actually afterward spending time with field biologists out in Borneo was a pretty informative experience for me.
When did you do that?
I did that on a trip to Indonesia. I was out there with Swimdo, who you know, doing drowning prevention. And so we were going to go work in a community doing drowning prevention, survival swim instructing on these river communities in Borneo, central Borneo. So we're talking about big brown rivers, villages built on stilts, very poor, mostly Muslim. And so a lot of the kids either knew how to swim already, or they just didn't know and they weren't going to be taught and they weren't going to know how to swim. That's kind of how it is, especially the girls who are wearing a lot more clothing. So that brought me to Borneo. Naturally, when you go somewhere, you want to link up with, you know, people who can show you around. I linked up with Borneo Nature Foundation. There's another nonprofit in Palangkaraya, which is where we went. And I got to see some people who were studying orangutans. There were some field stations. And, you know, it was really informative for me to see who these people are, what's their way of life. Like, what's it like when you're actually a field biologist? Like, you're out there, you know?
Yeah.
And for, I went with a couple of people, Seamus, who you met.
Yeah.
We had a really good group, and a couple of our Balinese friends went. And, you know, it was big. The Borneo Nature Foundation crew, they were super pumped to have us. Like, you know, not a lot of people are going to this area. So, you know, it's a little quiet. And we're in Los Angeles now. So it's quite a different lifestyle.
And so you got to go meet field biologists who were living this lifestyle, and what did it feel like to you? Were you there and you're like, whew, this is a lot of time alone? Or were you like, I want this. This is going to be my life? Because I do think there are a lot of careers like that. Like Nat Geo photographer might be a parallel one where people are like, this seems awesome. And then, yeah, you go see it and you need to determine whether or not you have the appetite for that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, I think the Nat Geo photographer, you nailed it. Like I saw a man talk here in Santa Monica, I've heard his name, but he, you know, he talked about, which is a lot about what I saw in those field biologists, which is that you're spending a lot of time alone. You know, it's rewarding. You're doing what you want to do if that's what you decide to do. But I think you sacrifice a lot and you really have to be passionate about it. And I think that for me, I love bugs. I love nature. I love digging out in the jungle and taking a motorbike out there and just getting weird. But I don't want to do that every day. I think that I'm a social person. I want to be doing a lot. I like to have a lot of friends. I like to be out having all these adventures. But I think for me, the loneliness, I was not down for.
Yeah.
And I think that part of me, I'm down for that in spurts, but it's different if you're committing to a career of doing that. It's a big commitment, and it's hard, you know, like it's hard work, and it's a lot of unsung heroes doing that stuff, man. You know, I think the longevity in it is, it's rough. And it's also really linked to academia, which also, it's like, if you're in love with nature, it's hard to end up on the computer.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And a lot more and more of your time might be spent on the computer.
Yeah. I think that as time went on and I was really thinking about these things, I didn't see role models who I wanted to be like. I was like, you know, I don't think I want to be doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know what? I was already in the jungle. I went to Borneo.
Right.
I didn't need to be a field biologist out there. I went and I caught some sick bugs, dude.
Yeah.
You know? And I can do that.
Yeah.
So
there's definitely a wisdom in renting the Ferrari rather than buying it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like,
yeah, I think that that's, and I think a lot of times you can preserve your love for something a bit more and preserve not getting burnt out on it, right? There's fewer things sadder than burning out on the thing that you were in love with, because we just need, our brains need novelty. It needs difference. Like, it needs different environment, different vistas, different people to hang out with. And I think one of the keys to living a good life is recognizing our appetite for each thing. Like, some people just fucking love food. They can eat food all day long. Others maybe only need one or two smaller meals a day. Like, and that's the crazy thing about just humans, right? Is that we all have different appetites for different aspects of life. And recognizing and kind of tuning into what our unique appetite is, I think is a lot. It takes breaking out of identities, right? Because if you're like the bug guy and you're like, oh, I'm going to go do this professionally, then you got to be like, maybe I want to do something else. Am I the bug guy anymore?
Yeah. And you know what? It's pretty hard to just be a bug guy. But if you are a bug guy, you know, you're really coerced to be like the one kind of bug guy. Like, you can't just be out there like the generalist bug guy. Like, there's not a lot of generalist bug guys. Like, you're the aphid dude, you know? You know? And especially if you want to be one of the cool bugs, like, you want to be like the praying mantis guy, like, oh man, there's already some like super smart, mega accomplished praying mantis dudes or women out there doing incredible stuff. And it's like, oh, maybe there isn't a whole room for you there. So that was not appealing to me. That was like, there are people who are bee dudes or ladies, and that's cool. But I don't see myself being a specialist like that.
Right.
It's just not who I am.
Cool. So how old were you when you took that trip to Borneo?
I was 22. 22, maybe 23.
And that was after you were spending a lot of time in Indonesia.
Yeah, that first trip, I've been 3 times now to Borneo. I love it there. It's cool. Whoa. I mean, got a little tiny foothold in some awesome place. I'm gonna go back.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was probably like 3 months in to a about 5 month stint in Indo.
Cool. Oh, so you went from Indo to Borneo.
Yeah, well, Borneo is part of Indonesia, so I was in Bali mostly, but just kind of exploring other islands, and then this popped up as an opportunity with Swimdo, you know, making friends through the nonprofit networks. That
Borneo is part of Indonesia. I'm an idiot.
Yeah, man. So Borneo, you know why? I mean, I'll give you a break.
Thanks,
Borneo
has stupid.
Also has Malaysia. Part of Malaysia is on Borneo, so there's Malaysian Borneo, and then there's also Brunei, so the Kingdom of Brunei in the north. So those are at least 3 countries.
Got it. And how did you get involved with Swimdo, and what is it?
Yeah, so Swimdo, love Swimdo. So Swimdo is drowning prevention for kids in Indonesia. I got into it because I met Neil Fromm, so who is the executive director. He's an awesome guy. I met him actually swimming in Santa Monica at the beach.
No way.
So it was something we were doing through the surf school. We do these workouts and trainings, and me and Neil were doing open water race, and it was a great race. I had just done a lifeguard academy, so I was all juiced. I was feeling that was the best swimming I've ever done. And so we had a great race. I won. And he told me about Swimdo. It's something he had been working on with Seamus, who's the original founder, along with him, and got linked in that way. And I went out there with them. Supposed to be 3 weeks, and turned into 5 months.
Wow, it was supposed to be a 3-week trip.
Yep.
Damn. And then you're out there, and I wrote a story on Swimdo and got to see all that they were doing out there. And it's just a very basic survival swimming technique that can save a lot of lives. And it's something that, you know, a lot of tourists, when they visit Bali, when they visit Indonesia, don't really think about. And there's this wild paradox, right? But because it is this island chain where people go for water and for the ocean, for the surfing. And yet many of the locals don't know how to swim. So they never learned. It wasn't part of the culture. It was very inspiring to see 60 little Indonesian rugrats doing this like backstroke that could save their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. It was something that was really meaningful to me. I think really shaped a lot of who I am now doing that. Then I think on one level, there's this level of, you know, being a part of a program being created. And I think Indonesia is some of the magic of being in Southeast Asia is, like, you know, things work differently. And, you know, when you want to make a program, there's a certain way of doing it. You can just go out there and work with the right people and do that. And so it was a beautiful experience watching the kids roll up, 3 or 4 of them on a motorbike. You know, you don't need to get parental consent. You need to get, you know, the head of the village's consent. You know what I mean? And the kids are super excited to do it. But, you know, when you talk about drowning prevention and drowning, if a kid were to drown here in Santa Monica, it'd be crazy. You know?
Right.
It'd be big news. But over there, you ask an adult, you know, has a kid ever drowned around here? It's like, oh, yeah. Like, they drown sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, what's being done, you know? And so I think that's a beautiful thing about Swimdo. And Swimdo's fully Indonesian run now, and just amazing staff out there. And it's got great leadership. You met did you meet a goose out there?
I did meet a goose. Oh, yeah.
A goose and Indira, and they're incredible young professionals out there just changing their community, changing, you know, the world. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very cool. That was another striking thing about doing that story, which was that people who were just visiting Bali had no idea, but nearly everyone, whether they were Indonesian or expats who lived in Bali, knew someone who had drowned. You're there long enough, and then it becomes commonplace. So, it's a pretty remarkable, you know, stat that in Southeast Asia, drowning is the number one cause of death among children.
Yep, and it's not floods, it's not tsunamis, it's just
falling
going down
river.
The beach or falling into, you know, the water by the house.
Yeah. Wow. All right. So you spent that time in Indo, coming back now to we're gonna bring the audience back to California now. When did you decide to do the career shift into surf school?
Yeah, it's funny when you ask me. It's like, I don't really feel like I ever made the decision. It was,
right, just fell in.
Yeah, it was just really natural. I had done a little bit of, I studied biology in school, and I had been pursuing the bugs. And then
where'd you go?
I went to UC San Diego. So it's a great place there's a lot of medical stuff studying going on down there. A lot of my peers were going in the medical route. I did a little stuff in Natural History Museum, but I just wasn't feeling it.
It's a cool campus. My brother went to UC San Diego. So when I was like 12, 13, he was like 19. He went to, like, it's so funny, like, looking back on that, I was like, whoa, these guys are in college. They're so grown up.
And now it's like, oh,
these kids are in school. Totally. Oh,
children.
Oh, how time flies. But yeah, he was captain of the UC San Diego Surf Club. And he's like, if you ever go, I'll give you the key to Blacks.
Oh, man. That's the golden
ticket.
That
was the golden ticket. Didn't end up going, so I never got the key.
But. Yeah, I know. Blacks got me through school. School was hard down there. It was so hard. And, I was able to suit up in my room and run to Blacks. Pretty incredible.
Cool.
I was on the surf team. We did not have the key because some previous surf team captains had it taken away for throwing some parties out here. But, We did get to drive down there every now and then, but being able to surf that wave, I mean, it's a pretty incredible surf spot.
It's a
good
surf spot.
It is good wave, man.
Yeah.
It's good. And you know what? Like, it's a busy spot. It gets really busy, especially when the forecast says it's good, but it's just like anywhere. If you live there and you're just going regular, you're going to score.
It's got a pretty deep canyon outside of it, right?
Yeah, so
it's
a huge canyon,
so it doesn't break up the energy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's magnifying and refracting the energy. I think it's one of the coolest things to do is standing on top of the cliffs on a big swell and watching the wave. It almost breaks in half and then rebounds off itself, and then it looks like it's a perfect mixed swell, but it's just one swell.
Yeah.
It's incredible to see. It's like a physics program you're watching. Like,
so cool. Yeah, you're
stimulation.
Bringing me back to being like 12 and seeing my big brother in college, and I would scram down that little trail. What's that one called?
The Ho Chi Minh.
The Ho Chi Minh Trail. Yeah. So sketchy.
Yeah.
I remember surfing out there once when I was like 13. I thought it was in years. It was a super uncrowded day. And I'm just like, Grom, don't know what I'm doing. And there's a guy sitting out there. And I'm just like, for some reason, I just decided to like sit on him. And he looks over to me and goes, is there a reason you're sitting next to me? No, I'm sorry. I paddle away.
Like, oh, man.
You know, like those lessons you get when you're a kid that you like, oh, I just didn't know that I shouldn't sit right next to you when there's a whole open beach. Thanks.
Someday
appreciate
you
that.
Will, you'll teach the young grasshopper.
Yeah. You know? Okay, cool. So it was UC San Diego.
Yeah.
UC
so,
San Diego.
Surf school, coming back. I had moved to L.A., I was doing a biomedical engineering job, rough. I also became an open water lifeguard because I was like, okay, I'm going to need to dip out of this. I need to be by the ocean, be doing what I love.
That's well,
like,
you were an ocean water lifeguard.
Yeah, I went through the academy, got all set up, and then right as summer was going to start, I got a call. Right when I had first moved to L.A., you need money. So I'd thrown out some applications. This is in like October, November or something. And to some surf schools because I taught surfing through school. You know, it's a good job. It was awesome. I taught Northside Scripps to a lot of the international students. It was a great time. And I got someone reached out to me. Hey, you want to teach? And I was like, no, not really. Like, I'm doing this job. I'm going to be a lifeguard. But hey, maybe I will just for fun. Like, I really love teaching. I love surfing. And that really quickly turned into just like running a operation down on the beach. Really focusing on, youth surf camps, surf programming for kids in the community, and that's really the foundation of it. So now I oversee, it's a pretty major surf school. We do a lot. We're Redondo, Manhattan, Santa Monica, and Will Rogers, and I really love it. There's a lot. I think that for me, it was hard to kind of jump into running a surf school as a career. I think that as a surfer, I wouldn't see it. I don't want to
say
do
no,
that.
Say no more.
You know, and it's like, no, I don't want to be, that's the bad guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like you're like taking, I don't know. it's dirty. It felt
you're
dirty.
You're
you
the
know?
On-ramp for kooks.
Yeah. It's not even that, I got a lot I can say about that, but I think, yeah, it's just a bad look in general.
But it's
so it took me a long
kids,
time to get into.
Right. It's you're
yeah,
teaching
yeah, I focus
kids.
On youth programs right. And surf camps. And you know what? It's like, anyone who wants to take shots at it, they can talk to me. You know, no. I'm teaching water safety. We're showing kids how to enjoy the ocean, take advantage of this resource. It's not an exclusive thing we can be keeping to ourselves. Like, you got to share with the people. I grew up not in a surfing family. I didn't have any family friends who surfed. I saw surfers and told my mom, I want to do that. Like, and she was like, I don't know how I'm going to get you to do that. Right. You know, like, and that's the case for a lot of people. And kids want to surf.
Totally.
Kids want to enjoy the beach. And you know what? It's a healthy place. It's a place where kids can have good role models, good mentorship. Now doing this for a number of years, you know, I'm really passionate about those things, the mentorship, the community aspects. And, you know, I went to a national conference on camping, which was hilarious. It was awesome. I met some great people, yeah. You know, survival camps in Maine and dirt bike camp in Wyoming. It was tight. And
that's so sick.
Yeah, but you know, something that we were talking about is, you know, there's no other way in society where kids are interfacing with young adults 18 to 26, you know, where they're being exposed to new things, new ideas, role models. You know, kids, who do kids see? They see their teachers, their tutors, their soccer coach, and that's about it. Their parents and their parents' friends. That is a very limited scope in life, you know? So I think that's something I really take seriously through, like, my own work, who I'm hiring, who's working with these kids, and, like, dude, the impact is huge. So,
you know, they're so malleable at that age.
Yeah, it's tight. And,
it's remarkable. And that's a really good point, because at that age, too, as a parent, you are terrified that your kids are going to fall into some bad influences, because it just takes, like, 3 or 4 bad decisions. When you're in that, you know, youth age, like, it's just, you don't know who the fuck you are.
Exactly.
You have no idea who you are or what the world's really made of or consequences.
And what are you working with, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so.
Not much at all. So, having that time with kids is, I'm a huge fan of it. My friend Matt, who lives up in Santa Cruz, does this thing called Myers Surf Mentorship, where he's coaching more like young, amateur surfers who want to be professionals. And a lot of the work that he's doing with them, it's not about their bottom turn technique. It's about their mind. It's about their goals. It's about setting intentions, like these massively foundational concepts that you need to learn. And if you don't learn by a certain age, you're left way behind. It's a setback compared to kids who do interface with those mentors at that age.
Yeah, and I think that, that's awesome. That's great work. And I think that's just the core of what makes surfing so great. You know, I think for me, one of the things, when I see kids who are really lit up on surfing, especially when they're like, you know, they're about to break through and be like independent little groms out there, one of the things I talk to their parents are about is, hey, like, these are the other kids in the area who are also like in it to win it. Like, you guys got to make this little group of kids, like, be in a squad, you know, moms, like, you guys can share driving duties to take them surfing, but the kids then, they got a surf crew.
Totally.
You know, and like, when I started surfing, I didn't have a surf crew, but then when I got one, I was like, well, this is a game changer. This is great. And I'm going to Catalina tomorrow with my surf crew, you know, it's going to be sick.
Yeah.
So teach them, you know, have your crew, get good waves, you know, it's about good vibes and enjoying the beach, enjoying the oceans, but.
That's massive, man.
Yeah.
When we were young, there was this organization in Santa Cruz called The Core. And
Whoa.
Yeah. It was about as core as it gets.
Damn.
Wednesday nights, dude, you know, surf centric. They would do a contest every year. Wednesday nights, they would rent out this church. We could play dodgeball. We did just rad random kid stuff with adults, young adults who would like come, and that really did help form our crew in a pretty major way. And the difference between our crew and the guys who were like 6 years older than us, really the difference was that organization. Most of the guys older than us around the Santa Cruz area got addicted to heroin or meth, like most, like darkness. And I think that a huge amount of the reason why most of my friends were able to make it out was because exactly what you're saying. It's like, focus on the positive, healthy stuff that you can do as a kid, as a teenager, and distract yourself and exert yourself with that.
Yeah, exert yourself. Go to bed tired.
Yeah.
You know?
Tired dog is exactly. A happy dog. That's super cool. That's super cool. So you're down there on the beach now. You're teaching these kids surfing. And what are some other con? I'm just going to ask you because I think that it's like you have a unique perspective on that. What are some concepts that you, if you could just teach a class these kids, what are some concepts like on growing up, on ethics, and maybe you do this on while at the surf school that you wish you could impart to more kids, or that you think these like values that are incredibly helpful for kids at that age to adopt, and how do you see it transform them?
Are we talking about within surfing, or
it could be within surfing, but also greater, like through life? Because I just think that you have a unique perspective on what kids are going through at that time. Like, I don't hang out with kids.
Kids are crazy,
man. And I'm old enough to almost forget what it was like being that age.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I try to teach them to look out for each other, especially in the water. It's like saying, especially the more advanced kids, like, you know, these kids are going to be going out, going to surf Topanga, or maybe they're super pumped. They're going to go surf somewhere new for the first time. They're all nervous, and you know, I'll let them know, you know, you guys got to look out for each other. You got to be cool in the lineup, but like, just know, like, nobody's out to get you. Like, be cool and talk to some people. Don't be afraid to do that. Like, there's a place for you in the lineup if you guys are cool, and look out for each other, and you got good vibes. You know, You're not cooler. Don't try to be cooler than anyone else. You know,
right. Yeah. That's good. I like that. And what's your surf school called?
Aquasurf.
So and so people can go and they can check it out.
Yeah, we're down Tower 28, Ocean Park. Very grateful to be there. Great community, and you know, try to do good by the community down there.
Yeah,
I think that's an important thing. I think that's why surf schools get such a bad rep, as they often should. Probably they're going down and they're trying to monetize on something beautiful, but not really respecting, you know, these things that are important to respect the community. You know, that's what's the most important. So if you tramps it on that, like, yeah, you should be hated on.
Right.
You know, that is a big thing. So I think that's like something that I learned that made me more okay personally with doing the surf school and running it and overseeing it and running these camps, is that it is the, like, who are we servicing? Like, these are the kids in this community. If someone were to come at me in the water and be like, hey, what are you doing with all these kids out here? This is lame. I'd be like, dude, these are the kids who live here in this neighborhood.
Right.
You know, maybe their parents don't surf. They're working right now.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, what are you going to say to that?
Yeah, it's incredibly, yeah. Right? You know, to your point, like, it's rare to have a big brother or sister or mom or dad who were also surfers. It's like a tiny, tiny fraction.
Yeah, it's fucking, dude, and how, lucky, right?
So lucky. Yeah, and how do you, so did you get surf lessons when you were a kid?
Yeah, dude, I went to, it was just a dude with like a blacked out van and a couple soft tops, like classic. His name was Paul. He's Australian. Sick. And dude, he would just like, he'd be kicking back beers on the beach afterward and make us carry the surfboards. My mom said he never cashed the check she wrote him. He's just so disorganized. it was like classic, like out of a video. But yeah, no, it was great. But he hired a couple, dude, he hired like two instructors, and those guys were cool, and they ripped so hard, and that was important to me. I was like, okay, these guys shred, they're cool, and yeah, they were tight.
And you'd go down there in the summer and they'd push you into waves.
I just went 1 week twice, like two summers in a row.
And that was all time.
That was enough, yeah. That was good.
Fine. That's so fun.
On my way. And I surfed alone for a couple of years. I was in it to win it. I was down as a kid.
Yeah.
So like, all right,
you're definitely down to do shit on your own if you don't need a partner.
Nope. It's cool when you got a buddy, like, definitely. Yeah. Makes it nice, but yeah, you don't need it.
Okay, so where were we going surfing early on?
I was surfing this little beach called Cabrillo Beach in San Pedro, which is a tiny little baby closeout. It's so cold. Or a spot called Rat Beach, which is basically in the South Bay, kind of near Palos Verdes.
Cool.
Those are my two spots. And they're just like the babiest, coldest. Like, this is like where the seaweed accumulates, like at the bottom of like,
so
the end of a
smells,
beach.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Rat Beach and Cabrillo. But
those are your spots.
Yeah, yeah. They're good beaches, man. They're rad. Everyone's happy down there. No problems.
Yeah.
It's good.
That's great.
Good place, man. For a kid to just, you know, figure it out.
And then speaking to just kind of going off on your own and learning new shit, how did you find spearfishing?
Dude, so I think that a lot of these things come to us through great friends. I had a really good friend, still do, his name's Adam, down in San Diego, and he actually tried getting me into it when I was probably about 20, maybe it was 19 or 20. It was hard. It was cold.
So uncomfortable. Gear
didn't fit me right. Mask kept fogging up. It took me a night. I was like, this is crazy. You know, it didn't really stick. I was pretty hyped on surfing at the time and just didn't have a place in my life yet, but I came back around to it like, you know, four or five years ago. And I don't really know. I don't even remember how it happened. I was talking to people about it. I was like, I'm fucking, I'm going to go for that again. Like, let's do that. That sounds like what I need. And especially, I surf a lot. I do, you know, I run surf programs for kids. It was like, it just felt like I needed something else for sure. I wasn't burning out on surfing per se, but I just needed something else.
Yeah. Flat day fun.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, I can, when it's flat, I can do this. I can do this at night. Are you kidding me? Like, I got an ocean activity at night. That's a game changer. Yeah. That's like a real one. Yeah, so that kind of started it, but that was just like the first, as the first stones were flipping over and I was discovering things about it. I fell in love with it pretty quick. And, you know, I think that was when, I think that what I've been reflecting on recently, because I've been thinking about this myself, because I'm so into spearfishing. I'm into diving, love it, love being underwater. Like, if I'm stressed, like, I don't want to come back up to the surface. You know, you want to stay down there. It's great. But, it's the same thing with the bugs. It's like you're exploring nature. You're experiencing like an ecosystem. You can really get into it. With the bugs, I'm just looking at it with my eyes. But like when you're diving, you're in there. And so starting to understand when it's good, what fish are around when, why they're there, trying to decode it. There's just like an endless Pandora's box of like things you can learn about. And I think that with surfing in recent years, it's kind of funny, like, I think I get more joy just from being where the waves are good than from actually surfing them. Because I look at charts all the time. I love it. I love the forecasting. I'm like, oh, I think it'll be good here, but maybe there. Like, and I love that. I love the search. Like, it's my, I love it so much. Sometimes the waves will be so good, I'll get a couple waves, and I'll be like, oh, I'm good. And I have to remind myself to keep surfing. Hmm. It's kind of funny. It's like I get one good barrel. I'm like, oh, I'm good. No. You should get some more tubes, dude. Yeah. But, you know, so I think with spearfishing and diving, it was like kind of combining this like forecasting, which is like large scale natural understanding, with then like the small scale of like the kelp forests and the seasons, and there's so many factors. Like, imagine if to go surf and get good waves, you had to understand water temperature, moon phases, seasons, like what's going on with like the chlorophyll levels in the water. Like, you know, there are just so many more factors. Like, if you had to know all that, just get good
waves. It's a whole nother level of factors. I mean, surfing, it's like, okay, swell, tide, wind, bathymetry of the spot. Then, yeah, it's a whole nother, like, five that you're starting to think about. So it's, you want lack of swell, lack of wind. You want there to be no algal bloom. What are other ones that you're looking at?
Well, just kind of looking for the signs, you know, like what's going on in the ocean when I'm surfing. Is it fishy? Like, one spot, it'll be fishy one day and it's not fishy the next. Like, it's like a ghost town out there.
Yeah.
And trying to understand that, like, oh, this fish is here. Maybe that fish will be here, you know, because like you got to notice every little thing, like, oh, like I'm seeing this. Like, last time I saw that, I shot a fat halibut.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know how they're connected yet, but they are. There's just like this whole world that's been opening up to me. And it's like, and I think that it comes, that's what I love about surfing. Also, I think at its fundamental level is like, I love just being out in nature, you know, growing up surfing, I would surf a lot of points with a lot of rocks and a lot of kelp. And, you know, there's a lot going on out there. And I think that, I'm more interested in that than I am in trying to, you know, release my fins. You know what I mean? Like, it seems to matter a lot less.
Right.
Yeah, to me, especially. It's like, yeah.
It's a whole different way of interacting with the water. And when I had a kind of a similar thing with spearfishing where people were like, this is the shit, you need to get into it. I was up in Santa Cruz surfing a lot, and I did it. And every single time I did it, I was like, this is hell. This is the most uncomfortable. I can't clear my ears. There's way too much gear. I feel like I'm drowning and I'm not shooting fish.
Yes.
And this is pretty scary also, but I'm not going to admit that. And then
it's the best part.
It's the best part. Yeah. And then like, and then something switches where you just have one good day. And I don't think I've ever felt as relaxed and blissed out as coming in from a good spearfishing session. Got a string of fish, your buddy's coming in, it's sunny, you're out there by yourselves. It's like there's this feeling of being really in the wild, even though you're only on this thin seam of society. Just, you're just right across it. Like, it's the fastest way to get out in the fucking wild as you can get.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm so in, man. It's so damn fun when you get a good day of visibility.
I love it. I love it so much.
We gotta get the kayak thing going,
dude. I'm trying to step it up.
We gotta get the kayak. We gotta get the SUP. I went. My buddy Tyler and I did some spearfishing like south of Santa Cruz. I told you he had these blow up SUP setups. They're such a game changer because we've just been going from the shore.
Yeah.
And it slows you down. You can only get so far.
Long walk down the cliff.
Yeah.
Carry all
your gear. Blow up SUP is, I think that should be the next move for sure.
Or a boat.
Or there's a boat. Or we could just get a fucking yacht.
I'm exploring
some
boat options. Yeah. I'm like,
you're in.
Get out there. Get to the islands. Yeah. We're just the blue water. So
that's where it's all
happening.
Blue
water stuff is pretty cool too.
Tell me your yellowtail story.
Okay, so,
and for people who aren't spear fishermen, maybe give them a little like background on what.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, as a diver, spear fisherman in Southern California, we start just diving off. You know, the shore. We're doing shore dives. We're looking for a reef fish. Usually, the fish you're starting out, you're pretty excited about are like the calico bass, the sheephead, things like this. Now, in California, we do have awesome fish. We get big pelagic fish. They do come up. The most prized local fish would be the white sea bass and the yellowtail. These are pretty majestic, big fish. They're awesome. So my friend Adam, who originally got me into spearfishing, who I'm very jealous, he had gotten into it when we were in high school. I was like, man, I've snoozed on that one. But he rang me up. He introduced me to a guy named Trevor. Trevor's the best fisherman I know now. Best fisherman I'm friends with. This guy's rad. He knows where the fish are. He loves it. He's in it when he's got salt water in his veins, and he is a gnarly diver. So I saw a good weather window, and I hit up Trevor. I was like, Trevor, like, let's go dive. He's got a boat. You want to know? You got to have your friends with boats. I hit him up. I was like, oh, I might be free this weekend. It's summer season for me. And he's like, yeah, you want to go tomorrow? And I was like, oh, man. Like, it was Monday. So I hit him up on a Sunday. I was like, oh, crap. Can I go? And so I was like, you know what? I'm doing it. I'm pulling the trigger. I'm driving from LA to San Diego tomorrow, 4 a.m. Got to be at the dock at like 6:15. We're going to go. I don't know where we're going. Trevor knows where we're going. So we end up going down to these islands called the Coronados. They're technically in Mexican waters over the border from San Diego. We're going for yellowtail. I'm like, all right, let's do this. Now I'd shot, at this point, I'd shot two yellowtail, I think, one on a trip to Mexico and one kind of doing some blue water stuff out here. So I was ready. I was down, had my gun, I was rigged appropriately. I got a blue water gun pretty recently that I was pretty pumped to use.
What's a blue water gun for you?
A blue water gun is a big gun, you know, so it's a big gun. Usually, most of them are wood, teak wood. You can get some carbon fiber stuff, but really what's important about it is it's big and it has a lot of bands on it. Why? Because you're shooting big fish. Okay. You want more range, you're shooting a bigger shaft and you need to get it through a bigger fish. So you're strapped with some power, you know? So my blue water gun is, four bands on it. It's pretty big. You got it rigged to a float line, but I have 100 feet of line. It could be float, might not be, but you got to have a float and a buoy at the end because whatever you shoot, you might not want to wrestle that with your hands immediately. Like think Jaws when you shoot a harpoon into Jaws, into the shark, and he's got the big old barrels of air behind it. It's basically that rig, but a little bit smaller because you're not shooting Jaws, ideally. Anyway, so we're out there. We had pretty great visibility. Didn't see any game fish for the first like 2 hours of the dive. We moved spots, still not seeing anything, and the vis is getting a little worse, but we start to see more bait fish. So it's kind of on. It's me, Trevor, two other guys. One of them, his name is Manfredo. He's Italian. He's a scientist at Scripps. rad guy, cool diver. And we're out there, and we're yelling at each other, hey, there's some sign over here. You know, we're talking. There's a chum line, like a slick line, where this, like, kind of this algae fuzz foam was developing coming off this point from the currents. So we're like, okay, there's a lot of current there. That's the spot. So we're kind of lingering around there, just doing random drops, dropping, hanging out, maybe at 15 feet, maybe at 30 feet, just kind of scoping out. Nobody had seen any fish yet. Eventually, I see some yellowtail. I dove down probably about 12 or 15 feet, not that deep, you know, pretty shallow, but that's where these fish called blacksmiths were. Now, the blacksmiths have some sort of relationship with yellowtail. I don't know what it is, but they're the bait fish. I don't think the yellowtail even eat them. I don't know. Maybe they do, but I don't think so. But when you see them, that's kind of a sign. Every time I've seen yellowtail, these fish are there. They're in the water column, kind of almost like a mat, like a layer, a blanket, just somewhere in the water column. And so I go down. I'm basically right on top of the blacksmiths, sitting there, and then just like a dream. Like the way it happens is just so crazy in the ocean. Like a dream, it probably about 5 or 6 yellowtail just cruise out of what was my range of vision from the visibility, and they're just there. It's like they're not there, and then all of a sudden they're there. They're like right in front of you, and you're just like, holy shit, I've been diving for 3 hours. I'm just out here off this island. There's for sure a bunch of white sharks that come here sometimes. Like this is, I'm already just like succumbed myself to like, all right, like whatever happens, happens, I'm in this. And then boom, there's fish in front of me. Perfect. Light on my shot. Take the shot. Nail. Nice size yellowtail, and I am pumped. I am so pumped. Fish dives straight down. I've got a slip tip rig. I know I have a good shot in it.
Slip tip rig.
So a slip tip is when the end of your spear is, it kind of comes off the end of your spear with about, you know, 16 inches of line. That way the fish is fighting without this giant metal rod in it. It's kind of just fighting this little piece of string. So it basically makes it so that it's harder for the fish to pull out and tear out, so we get a better hold on it. So I'm pulling it, this fish, things are going well. I'm getting ready. You got to get in the zone. Like, all right, I'm going to pull my knife out now. Like, all right, I'm getting the knife. I can see the fish, bringing him in closer. I made a few mistakes here that I learned from, but I'm pulling him in.
What were the mistakes?
I pulled my knife out too early. I should have waited to grab the fish and then pull my knife out. But I pulled my knife out first, and then I'm kind of like doing this thing where I'm pulling the fish in. I'm using 2 fingers in my left hand instead of all 5. Whatever. I'm pulling him in. I got the fish like 4 feet away. And he's a bigger fish. You're like kind of doing the depth. Oh, can I reach him? I'm reaching to try to reach him. I can't reach him. Okay, crap. So he kind of makes a run, pushes out. I got to pull him in. And then I hear Manfredo, my Italian diver friend, yell, "Seal!" And I look up and I don't see anything. I don't know what he's talking about. I'm like, oh, that doesn't sound good. And so I pull up the fish and I'm just reaching. I'm extending to grab him. He's like right there. I'm just trying to grab him by the tail. And then like a flash of brown just comes in a big bull sea lion, big knot head, like 400-pound sea monster comes with his mouth open. And he's coming from my right. So he's like outside of my field of vision. And then boom, he's in my just like, fills up my entire frame of vision, grabs the yellowtail like basically out of my hand. Like I'm like freaking out, and he takes it. He just grabs the fish and he just goes straight down. And now these sea lions, they know what they're doing. He knew the sound of that spear gun. He's probably sleeping like a couple hundred meters away, and he's like, oh, dinner time. And he went straight down. I just see my lines going, my lines running. I grab my float line. Tighten my grip, I just start getting pulled down, so I let go. And then my buoy comes, my big float buoy. I grab the buoy thinking, I can fight him with the buoy a little bit, try to maybe he'll let go. No, dude, buoy just goes straight down. I'm holding on to it for like 5 or 6 feet under the water, and then I'm like, I need to let go. I'm not gonna do, what am I gonna do? So I let go and I just watch my buoy just disappear down into the water. Just gone. Gone. I come up and I'm there with my gun with not loaded. And my spear shaft, my float line, my buoy, it's all just gone. And I'm looking on the surface, and I don't see it. It's just gone. And so I'm like, what the fuck? What do I do? So I go to the boat. I'm looking around, and then I see it. It's like a couple hundred meters out to sea, getting dragged, and the big bull sea lion, he's got my yellowtail in his mouth and all my gear, and he's just going out to sea. So I'm like, at this point, this is where the situation gets a little worse. It's like, oh, I can't even do anything right now. So I got to call Trevor. Trevor! He's like, what? I'm like, dude, we gotta, I need the boat. Like, we gotta go get this. I gotta go get my gear. So we, he comes up, we pull anchor, we go out there. We gotta wrestle the, my gear out of this freaking giant sea lion's mouth, get it back. It's an ordeal. We go, we drop anchor again. Trevor wants to get in the water. He wants to shoot a yellow. That was the first yellow any of us had shot.
Okay. The yellow, yellow tail, it's gone though.
Yeah. Oh yeah. He's way gone. He's like devoured. Like, he's devoured. We got to the sea lion, like, it's just like the head of the fish. And then like my spear tip stuck in it. And then eventually we like wrestle it out. So it's gone. Now this is like where it gets like more ridiculous, where we drop anchor and I'm kind of just de-stressing for a minute before I go back to dive, try to do it again. Trevor jumps in, and then here comes the sea lion, and he just comes and he's just floating next to the boat, just sleeping there, waiting for the next fish to get shot. So, and this is a huge animal. Like, this is like 400 or 500 pounds. You know, it's like when a gorilla is like a silverback gorilla. This is like the blonde back sea lion, you know, the big alpha males.
Yeah.
You know, so this guy probably does it at boats all day, whether they're fishing boats or spearfishing. So, you know, I go back in, and like, I'll never forget, like, I did a drop. And I didn't know the sea lion was near me. And I just, like, I was probably, like, 30 feet. It was cool down there. I was chilling. And I look over, and he just swims right by me, just looking at me. I'm just like, oh, my God. Sea monster, dude. Oh, my gosh. But anyways, I got another fish. I got a really nice fish after that.
You got another yellow.
He actually, the sea lion actually stole one of Chris, the fourth guy on the boat, stole one of his fish.
Really?
And then he went and napped it off, I guess, and let us get a couple more.
But, and was that your first yellowtail?
No, luckily. Yeah. Okay. But I did shoot my biggest that day, though. It was probably about like a little over 20 pounds, 22, 25 pounds maybe. But that was crazy, man, honestly.
That was a great story.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was really scary. And, you know, it's funny. It's like I told Trevor about it. You know, I told you, Trevor's the best fisherman I know. He's a gnarly diver, 80, 100-foot diver. This is the guy who we went for bluefin, and he's like, "There's fish at 80 feet. Get in." It's like, oh, okay, like, yeah, it's gonna jump off the boat and pop an 80-foot drop, and you know that's what some people do. It's pretty intense, but you know, he was like, "You gotta hold on to the fish. You gotta grab it faster." I'm like, "Oh my gosh," you know. He's like, "You gotta fight off the sea lion," but in that moment, it didn't feel like I could do anything. But having learned from that, now when I shoot a yellowtail, especially if I'm in blue water or shoot any kind of big fish, like, I'm grabbing that fish and I'm hugging it to my chest. And if there's a boat there, I'm going to go, I'll bleed it and kill it by the boat. You know, I'm not going to take my time anymore. So I learned my lesson. I think if I pulled that fish in faster, I would have kept it. But that sea lion was on a mission, man. And he was good. He was big. Yeah.
That's a sick story.
Dude,
kinda. Such a good story. God, dude, hunting and fishing stories are just the best. They're just the best. I'll never get sick of them, and I hope to have many, many in my life, because just makes life way better when you are cooking dinner that you killed yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I think, like, I've lived my life in the ocean, and like, I have a very healthy respect for the ocean. But, like, having an experience like that, where, like, an animal encounter like that is pretty intense. And, like, I was like, wow. You know, I'm glad he didn't go for my hand.
A small bear coming in to fucking
or
get your
big
deer.
Bear, dude.
Big bear. Yeah.
To be honest, it's like a grizzly bear. Like, it was not a black bear. It was a grizzly. It was huge. Yeah. Enormous. Like, that's gnarly. And underwater, it looks even bigger, dude. It's like, the power when I grabbed the buoy and I tried to, like, think I could, like, wrestle it underwater, it was like, it was like I wasn't even there. I was gone, you know.
Oh, so, that's so sick.
Yeah, healthy respect for the sea lions. I don't love them, but you know, they're out there. They don't want anything to do with us, luckily, right?
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah. Where are you? What are you most excited about moving forward with in spearfishing? What are the goals you got?
Yeah. So, I think that what I'm most excited for is, I think that Southern California rocks. We got these islands out here. I'm really looking forward to exploring the islands, really learning about some of these bigger fish and what makes them tick and how to get them. I love getting my friends more into it and getting my friends better. Like, dude, that's the best. I want to, here we have bluefin tuna that come up in the summer now. It's a new thing. It only started like 7 or 8 years ago, apparently. Before that, it was like 100 years. So it's a new natural phenomenon that's sweet, but also probably concerning on like a deeper level. Like, where were these fish before and why aren't they there anymore? But it's pretty epic. It's pretty full on out there. So, you know, people are pioneering different ways of really approaching the bluefin tuna out here. And I've had the privilege of going out on 2 days and seeing them in the water, and it's pretty incredible. So I want to push that a little further, not so much to shoot a bunch of fish, but it's pretty crazy just being in blue water. It's pretty cool. I want to like learn that a little more. It's super scary. But I've already seen some of the most incredible natural things I've ever seen in my life anywhere in the world right here. And so it's on out there. It's right here in our backyard. So I'm looking into really approaching the blue water stuff, but it's exciting. It's just as exciting for me to go for a shore dive, you know, yeah, figure stuff out and, ooh, maybe it's grunion run, like the halibut are in. That stuff, that stuff loves. I love it.
Yeah. Well, man, you got a sick attitude and, I love adventuring around with you. For people who got curious about entomology and were like, you know what, maybe that's my calling, is there a way that any like books or resources you'd recommend for people?
I
think are really good, or even just way things to look for on their next hike if they want to notice bugs more?
Yeah. So I would, there's a couple really good resources if you want to get into like identification, really learning about what you're seeing. iNaturalist is awesome. Citizen Science, people post pictures of the bugs they see. Experts will identify them for you. I've always, growing up, I use a platform called Bug Guide, which was pretty good for taxonomy. Taxonomy is hard. Identifying creatures, if you want to identify a bug to species level, it's not easy. Like, you need professional help, literally. And just, you need to have, be professional to even understand the literature that helps you see what you're looking at. Even after working hard at it, it's like, it's an art form that, you know, I worry about what, how it's going to work in the future. I mean, if there's enough bugs to look at anyway, but, I am a member of the Lorquin Society in Los Angeles. It's like 100-year-old entomological society. I don't go to as many meetings as I wish I did because they're on Friday nights. But they're pretty rad. I think there's a lot of clubs out there. They do get togethers. People talk about what they're seeing, what they're finding. They'll get professionals to do talks. So that's pretty fun. But, you know, get out there, see what the plants are doing. It's springtime. You know, here I'm excited. I'm going on a trip to Sedona in a couple weeks. So I'm going to do a couple days driving out there through the desert. And I'm excited. The desert wildflowers are blooming. That means it's going to be all kinds of bugs. The bugs are stoked. Like, they're out. This is a great time. So springtime is a great time. They don't like winter. They don't like wind. But they love the flowers. So get out there and do that.
Kind of bugs are you looking for?
I'm going to be looking for primarily like different kinds of bees. There's a lot of bees out here in the Southwest, which is pretty incredible. Like, I found like 15 different kinds of bees in one day in the desert before. So that's pretty cool. I'll probably do some night walks for scorpions with a black light. I think that is so epic. Like, you got kids who are interested in bugs, or you're interested in bugs, get yourself a black light, or you're just doing any camping, get a little handheld black light torch, walk around your campsite and check out your neighbors, your little buddies. You might be freaked out to see how many there are, but that's pretty fun. I don't like catching too many scorpions. I'm not collecting tons and tons of bugs, but when I see something I recognize as special, something I want to learn about, that's when I'm gonna, like, you know, consider collecting it.
My man, this was such a blast. If people want to reach out to you, how can they get in touch? So we got
Instagram.
What's your Instagram?
Dylan Sonjan. Little underscore. Nothing fancy.
Dylan Sonjan. And Surf School one more time.
Aqua Surf School.
Here in LA. This was such a blast. Everything I hoped for and more. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.